Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 25th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Over the last months, we at LaRouche PAC have been warning that the insane President of the United States, Barack Obama, has been intending to repeat the violent and murderous regime change which he illegally led in Libya, this time in Syria. For a variety of reasons, this has not yet happened. Those reasons include strenuous resistance from the governments of Russia and China, resistance as well from sections of the U.S. military centered around the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as from retired members of the military, intelligence, and diplomatic communities. And those reasons also include the mobilization, the ongoing intensifying mobilization of LaRouche PAC following Lyndon LaRouche's warning at the end of October 2011 that Obama was committed to overthrowing Assad and bombing Iran's nuclear research centers, even if those actions would lead to a thermonuclear confrontation with Russia and China. Despite the qualified success in holding off World War III thus far, that danger has intensified in recent days and weeks, with the Obama administration discussing proceeding with a no-fly zone over Syria, even without UN or, of course, U.S. congressional approval. And Obama himself spoke of a possible U.S. attack on Syria just the other day if a red line is crossed involving Syrian use of chemical weapons, which is another one of these Tony Blair-style hoaxed-up argument for a war. Now, at the same time that Obama's Nero-type mentality has pushed us to the brink of war, there are others who seem to be learning from LaRouche's intervention in strategic policy, especially since his role in developing the Strategic Defense Initiative in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And with the recent success of the Curiosity rover on Mars, there's been a renewed discussion of the prospect for especially U.S.-Russian collaboration for peaceful purposes as opposed to confrontation over illegal regime change. In a recent document related to this, which LaRouche has titled Edward Teller Was Right at Erice, The Threat Against Mankind, LaRouche wrote, and this is a quote, "Many seeds cast in history remain merely seeds. Others become history," unquote. As LaRouche has cast seeds that have become history, notably his string of accurate economic forecasts and his role in the SDI, today on the program we're going to look into LaRouche's analysis of the current threat from the standpoint of the method by which he's been successful in the past in matters of war and economics. And from that, how we can turn this impending cataclysm into a new era of peace and cooperation. Joining me today on the program to discuss this is someone who's been at LaRouche's side through many of these developments over the last 40 or so years, Jeffrey Steinberg. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start with the obvious question. Where do things stand at this moment with this war danger?
Well, I think the crucial event that people should have their eyes on is the upcoming Democratic nominating convention, which begins on September 3rd in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I was in a discussion earlier today with Mr. LaRouche and a whole group of colleagues, and he put the issue on the table very, very clearly. He said, if Obama is successfully given the Democratic Party nomination for president, and especially were he to win re-election, then it is near to a certainty that he will very rapidly bring the United States into a situation where we are facing general war that would very rapidly, make, perhaps from the very opening salvo, be a thermonuclear war and one that could lead to human extinction. That's the danger here. What's going on the ground in Syria and with respect to the Iran situation are merely the cockpits, the pretexts for starting a general war in which the principal targets are Russia and China. This has been the ongoing policy of President Obama since the time of the invasion and overthrow of the government of Libya, ending with the summary execution without a trial of the head of state, Muammar Gaddafi. The intention of Obama and a faction in Britain and in some other countries in Europe, but especially in Britain, was to move immediately from the overthrow of Gaddafi to a similar targeting of the Bashar Assad government in Syria. And the final target in this drive for general war was to be Iran, whether it was through an Israeli attack backed up by the United States or a US-NATO attack. So what Obama is proceeding on is a course for general war at a point that the Russian and Chinese governments have both made absolutely clear that this course of action will lead to thermonuclear war and the potential extinction of human life on this planet.
Now, let me just break in here, because this is where, in a statement he put out this week that was distributed widely in Washington, Lyndon LaRouche said that when he makes that statement, a common reaction is, oh, that's over the top. And yet, some of the people who say that's over the top are well aware that LaRouche has been accurate in his forecasting. Why is it that LaRouche can make a statement like that and know that it's accurate?
Well, you know, in the discussion with this whole group of colleagues this morning, which went for about an hour and a half or so, one of the themes that that Mr. LaRouche went back to time and again was his own experience having fought in World War II. He was in the Medic Corps, and he was in Burma in the Pacific Theater during the final year or so of the war. And he was 19 years old when the attack on Pearl Harbor happened. He has vivid memories of exactly where he was and what happened that day and the profound change in the American people. But he said that once Hitler was defeated, once we had achieved victory in Europe, for the balance of the war, even there was already a pattern of moral decay showing in the American population. It was in some respects capped by the transition from President Roosevelt, who was a hero and who led the country into the successful defeat of the Nazis, to President Truman, who was a pathetic figure and who basically issued the orders to use atomic bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan at the point that the U.S. already knew that Japan was ready to surrender. And all that needed to be done was to tighten the blockade, and you would have had a full surrender within a matter of weeks or months without unleashing thermonuclear terror. So you've had this degeneration to where people do not want to face reality. Things got bad in Lynn's own generation, and he'll be 90 years old next month, early next month. Things got worse with, as he described it, the 68ers, the kids my age and your age who were basically in their early teens when John Kennedy was assassinated and it was covered up, and they fled reality because it was too frightening and horrible and got caught up in drugs and everything else.
And then now, we got back to reality.
Yeah. And then you have the generation who are the offsprings of the 68ers. So what you're dealing with here, even among people who see that Obama is a dangerous Nero type figure who's driving the country to one war after the other, people basically do get frightened. They don't say that LaRouche's warnings about thermonuclear war are over the top because they have any counter arguments to demonstrate that there are built-in safety valves and that it won't happen. They are just in a state of fear, and therefore the most frightening thing one could imagine is thermonuclear extinction. And so they just simply go into angry denial. And that's a very, very dangerous thing when you've got someone like Barack Obama in the White House who has committed himself to driving the country to strategic confrontation with Russia and China, using Syria and Iran as the pretexts.
But let me just ask then the flip side of that question, is that why is Obama and why are his supporters and the controllers in the City of London so intent on this confrontation?
You've got splits in London, which showed up very dramatically at the beginning of July, when symbolically, I believe it was on the 4th of July, the Financial Times carried an editorial endorsement of reinstating Glass-Steagall, full bank separation between commercial banks and what the British call merchant banks, or we call investment banks. That was followed by comments from leading figures associated with the Rothschild banking interests, the Hambros, old investment banking family. And so there's clearly an element within the British oligarchy that understands that the factor driving towards war is the complete bankruptcy and disintegration of the transatlantic region, continental Europe, the British Isles, the United States, Canada. The economies are collapsing. The financial system is hopelessly and irreversibly bankrupt. And so the response of some more rational and forward-looking people in the British oligarchy is to say that we'll accept a temporary setback. We'll allow a return to Glass-Steagall, but we will hold on to our power and we'll do everything we can in the future to reassert our power for oligarchical principles. There's another faction very much tied to Prince Philip and the really hardcore genocidalist Malthusians, who basically say, if this system is going down, if our power structure is about to be brought down, then we're going to bring everything down with us.
And this is a faction that has been involved in the destruction of science, the attack on modern industry, and so on.
Exactly. Yeah, they're the authors of the Obama agenda of wiping out science and technology and basically going for radical population reduction. And what better way to radically reduce population than to start a world war at a point that the two leading military powers, the United States and Russia, have overkill arsenals of thermonuclear weapons, and China has its own growing arsenal of thermonuclear weapons that they would use in alliance with Russia against the United States and the West.
I'd like to just explore that a little bit, because this is one of the obvious points that there are some people who are still facing reality. And in particular, you see that from military layers, including General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. To what extent, I mean, Mr. LaRouche said that the two reasons we haven't been in war so far are Dempsey and Putin. To what extent do people in the Congress have some sense of this as a way of getting at reality?
There are individuals in Congress who have a sense of this. I mean, a good example of this is Congressman Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina, who originally came into Congress as a Democrat, and his father before him was an FDR Democrat. He's introduced a House concurrent resolution, number 107, saying that if any president attempts to bring this country to war without first getting the authorization of Congress, as spelled out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, then this will constitute an immediate impeachable crime. And Congressman Jones, who was interviewed a month or so back on this show, made very clear that this is not simply an abstract issue for him. He's gravely concerned since Libya that President Obama is driving the country to war in the Middle East, a war in Syria, a war against Iran, and with the danger of thermonuclear war. He's not specifying the Obama case because we want to make sure that future presidents are reminded as well that only the Congress has the authority to declare war. So there are individuals like Congressman Jones, there's a whole group of people who constitute themselves as a bipartisan war avoidance caucus. You have people like Congressman McDermott, Congressman McGovern. There's a small...
People like Senator Lugar who just came back from Moscow.
Very definitely. So you've got these individuals, but institutionally, the Congress is a mess because the leadership of the House and the Senate are a mess, and the political leadership of both parties are a mess. So Congress exists as a legislative branch, a House and a Senate, and they're supposed to function as branches of government. That's very different than having a handful of courageous individuals who don't have the capacity to move the legislative body as a whole. I mean, if we had a functioning Congress, President Obama would have been subject to impeachment proceedings at minimum after the Libya war because he adamantly refused on principle to go to Congress for authorization. That was a high crime and misdemeanor by anyone's standards, and there's many others that he's committed.
And he was aided in that by John McCain, Graham from South Carolina, Lieberman, but also John Kerry, the Democrat from Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, it's very important to remember one thing. Kerry and McCain introduced a resolution into the Senate to give President Obama authorization to continue the already illegal Libya war, but when it came up for debate and vote on the full floor of the Senate, Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid compared numbers and concluded that it would have been defeated. So therefore, they pulled the bill. So while there was an intent on the part of Kerry and McCain and the others you mentioned to give Obama cover for his unconstitutional actions, the fact is it never happened. So the Libya war was an illegal war by any criterion of the U.S. Constitution. It also, by the way, was an act of outright sabotage of the entire functioning of the U.N. Security Council. Because Russia and China were convinced to abstain from the vote rather than to veto the vote to establish a no-fly zone because they were convinced that there would be no effort at regime change and that it was merely to protect the residents of the Benghazi region who were in jeopardy. So once the camaraderie, once the collegiality of the permanent five members of the Security Council was violated, Russia and China simply said, we will never trust these bastards again until we're given good reason to. So that's why you've had vetoes of all of the Security Council resolutions that might be interpreted to give authorization for use of force in Syria. It's also why President Putin has now promulgated what is openly referred to as the Putin Doctrine, which says that any attempt to carry out regime change without the full authorization of the UN Security Council, any attempts at humanitarian interventionism or any of these other pretexts, will be a trigger for general war, and that war has the potential to be thermonuclear war. That was issued as a clear-cut warning by President Medvedev shortly before he and now President Putin switched positions. But it was widely briefed to diplomats over the world, all over the world, as the Putin Doctrine. And this doctrine has been thoroughly endorsed by China as well. In fact, the Chinese had that policy even before Putin, you know, formally declared the Putin Doctrine. So the U.S. is, Obama is messing with World War III, thermonuclear World War III, plain and simple.
You're listening to Jeff Steinberg on the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 25th, 2012, and we're discussing the very real and dangerous events propelling us toward a thermonuclear confrontation, ostensibly over the Middle East, but also we're going to talk about how to get out of this. Now, Jeff, just to go back to the Putin Doctrine, one of the key issues here is the development or the imposition of a new doctrine in the United States, the so-called responsibility to protect, which, as you say, is often used through the cover of humanitarian aid, but is really an attack on the idea of national sovereignty. Isn't that one of the core principles that Putin has been defending, the idea of national sovereignty, as opposed to this Blair-Obama doctrine of doing away with the nation state?
Absolutely. Look, you go back to April of 1999. That was during the Kosovo War. It was the 50th anniversary of NATO, and there was a major NATO conference in Washington. And during that period, Tony Blair, who was still prime minister, went to Chicago and gave a major speech at the World Affairs Council, basically announcing that with the invasion of Kosovo, the bombing of Yugoslavia, of Serbia, that the era of the Westphalian system was now coming to an end, and that no longer was national sovereignty an absolute principle in international relations, but that there were unnamed international agencies that would have the authority to proclaim when a government was carrying out actions against this population that warranted overthrow. So this is the concept of responsibility to protect. It's otherwise called humanitarian interventionism. And in fact, there is a former London economist writer who wrote one of the definitive books promoting the idea of humanitarian interventionism, and he traced the history of it back to the British Empire in the 19th century, when they used the anti-slavery leagues as justifications for invading and taking over nations that were colonies of some of their inter-imperial rivals in Europe. So the whole thing is imperialism in a post-Westphalian world. And that's what we're dealing with. That's what Obama is pledged to. And that's why, if this guy is allowed to be renominated, and especially if he's allowed to be reelected, then we're on a path to thermonuclear war.
But Jeff, besides, in the introduction, I mentioned there are other forces coming out now warning of this danger, both in terms of the danger of a U.S.-Russian confrontation, but now also, as well, U.S.-China. To what extent do we see this kind of activity becoming a little more prominent now?
Well, I think you've got persistent warnings coming from Russia since the immediate aftermath of the Libya war last October. There have been one after another statements from Putin, from Medvedev, from Foreign Minister Lavrov, from General Makarov, who's the chief of staff of the Russian armed forces. They've all made it clear that this idea of regime change from the outside without UN authorization is a recipe for nuclear war. The Chinese, in response to the US plans to build up a missile defense system in the Asia-Pacific region, have announced that they are prepared to abandon their historical doctrine of no nuclear first strike use. So all of these issues, which had been long buried with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, are back on the table for one and only one reason, and that's because Barack Obama is president of the United States. The British may be the guiding hand behind what Obama is saying and doing, but the British are pipsqueaks. They have no military capability. It's a joke. They, you know, you could go on a classified version of Craigslist or eBay and buy half of the British Navy, which has been mothballed because they can't afford it anymore. So their imperial policy is conducted through their control over the American presidency as long as Obama is in the White House. And people dislike Obama. They hate Obama. A recent poll showed that 73% of all Americans are completely disgusted with the idea that the choice in November is going to be between Obama and Romney. Obama could be dumped on a moment's notice. It could happen before September 3rd. The guy has committed a pileup of crimes that rise to the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanor warranting impeachment. Now, on this issue that you raised a moment ago about voices against this war danger, you have the Russian leadership, both military and civilian. They're unambiguous. They repeat it practically every week. China, similarly, there were also this past few days in Red Star, the official publication of the Russian military, articles warning about the war danger, particularly talking about the danger of a Syria action by the U.S. or an Israeli or Israeli-American attack against Iran. But they carefully noted that General Dempsey, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, is adamantly opposed to any of these wars, that there are institutional voices overwhelmingly in Israel, from the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, from the Mossad, from the Shin Bet, from military intelligence, who line up completely in lockstep in opposition to Netanyahu and Barak. President Peres, Shimon Peres, is on record repeatedly opposing an Israeli attack against Iran. And so you've got all of these voices, and of course, Lyndon LaRouche has been leading the war avoidance fight for more than the last 2 years, even before the Libya operation began, based on his April 2009 diagnosis that Obama was a dangerous narcissist who would tend, under pressure, to bring the world to war. So all of these forces are in motion, but as long as Obama remains on the job, in office, then the danger will persist. There were numerous efforts over the last 2 years to challenge Obama for the Democratic nomination for president, but all of those offers ultimately failed to materialize. There were people, Democrats, wealthy Democrats, one in particular, who offered to put up $10 million if a credible candidate had agreed to challenge Obama in the primary elections, to blow things up. Had there been any serious move in that direction, you would have had a replay of 1968 or something like that, when Lyndon Johnson was forced to actually take his name out of the running for president, even though he was the sitting president at the time and was sure to get the nomination.
Jeff, I think the case of Lyndon Johnson is an interesting one because he stepped down after an opponent, Senator Eugene McCarthy, got around 40% against him in the New Hampshire primary. If you look at what's happened with Obama, I think there are four or five states where either an opponent or an uncommitted slate got 40% of the vote against him in the Democratic primaries. And then if you look at the LaRouche case, the two elections, the Keisha Rogers' victory, where she got over 50% of the vote campaigning as a Democrat to throw Obama out, and then just a few weeks ago, Bill Roberts in the 11th District in Michigan got 41%. So it was not just anti-Obama, but a clear alternative economic policy, strategic policy. So if you can't get more than 60% of the vote in your own primaries, it's going to be difficult to put forward the argument that you're a popular candidate. And I might add, Romney only got about 36 to 40% of the vote in the Republican primary.
Yeah, that's where I say 73% of the people polled in a very extensive poll that was conducted about a month or so ago basically said there's no choice here. There's no good option. And so we're heading into a Democratic nominating convention, and let's be very clear. There are no binding rules mandating that delegates who are coming into the convention as Obama delegates, or in the case of the Republicans as Romney delegates, that they've got to vote for those candidates. They are completely free to vote their conscience. So, you know, there needs to be a fight at the convention. We know from one of the Obama biographies that at a certain point there had been enormous pressure on Hillary Clinton to resign as Secretary of State and to challenge Obama in the primaries. And for a variety of reasons, she chose not to do that, which was quite unfortunate. So here we are, less than 2 weeks away from the Democratic nominating convention. We're just 48 hours away from the Republican convention. And the country is being left with no viable choices for president at a time when we're facing thermonuclear war and the greatest economic disintegration since the founding of our republic. That is a state of affairs that bodes very poorly for the survival of the United States and makes it very clear that there is something morally profoundly wrong with the American people, that they tolerate this state of affairs.
Well, I think people can go to the LaRouche PAC website and get the statement that was written for the Day of Action in Washington on Wednesday from Lyndon LaRouche on precisely this, a challenge to the American people to get back into the real world. So that's available on the LaRouche PAC website. And I'm assuming that this new article on Edward Teller, I don't think it's done yet, but I think that will be up shortly. That brings me to the other side of this whole picture, which is that even as the Russians are warning that they may have to launch a strike against U.S. positions or even a nuclear strike against the United States if this insanity continues in Syria and Iran, at the same time, the Russians have been offering a very broad framework for discussing collaboration, which they call the Strategic Defense of Earth. And since you were very much involved in the organizing around the original SDI, the original Strategic Defense Initiative, obviously this is a signal from the Russians that this idea, which President Reagan adopted, should be put on the table again. What kind of response is there from these institutional layers in the United States to this? Because obviously Lyndon LaRouche responded immediately. To what extent are we seeing signs that other people are getting the picture?
Well, there's very definitely back and forth discussions at a very high level, military to military and otherwise. I'll just point to two other very precise examples of where you've got this process of high level discussion. Back in February, at the time of the annual Wehrkunde European Security Conference that takes place in Munich, a report was issued and circulated to everybody attending that conference by a U.S.-Russian-European group of former government officials, leading scientists, called the European American Security Initiative. They published a 25 or so page report. It got very wide circulation at the time. And basically what they said is that there are two critical areas for collaboration between the United States and Russia and Europe. And one of those areas is to go forward with the original Ronald Reagan proposal for Strategic Defense Initiative. In other words, building an integrated global system of defense against offensive thermonuclear weapons to render them obsolete. And the second issue that they talked about was collaboration on developing the Arctic region, which is one of the wealthiest untapped sources of strategic raw material wealth left on the planet. And so these are two ideas that have been long promoted by Lyndon LaRouche. LaRouche was the author of the original Strategic Defense Initiative proposal adopted by President Reagan. The second example of this is a report that was issued just in the past week by a commission that was created by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton almost 2 years ago, an independent commission on global security. And the mandate of that commission was to develop a framework for what was referred to as a doctrine of mutually assured stability, very similar to the mutually assured survival, which was synonymous for the SDI. The commission was co-chaired by William Perry, who was President Clinton's Secretary of Defense. It involved a number of other well-known diplomats, Robert Gallucci, and also included Graham Allison, who had a number of government posts, again, in the Clinton administration. And the report called for about 15 areas of U.S.-Russian cooperation. And the cornerstone of the whole report was they said, look, whatever issues of dispute and disagreement may exist between Russia and the United States, those points of disagreement never rise even close to the threshold of issues that would prompt war between those two countries. So there's a lot of this kind of stuff going on. General Dempsey spoke at a conference in Norfolk back in May, and basically said that the U.S.-Russia military-to-military relation is strategic, it's global, and that whatever disagreements they may have over the Syria situation is minor compared to all of the areas of high-level cooperation. And he announced then that General Makarov, his Russian counterpart, would be his guest in Washington in July, and that during those talks he expected that they would resolve the disputes over this European ballistic missile defense deployment. So all of these things exist. They are all echoes and shadows of LaRouche's original SDI. And yes, the Russians have taken things one step further because they've pointed out that not only do we have the threat of extinction from lunatics on this planet who might be tempted, as in the case of President Obama, to actually provoke a thermonuclear war, but there are dangers, asteroids, comets, other objects coming at the Earth that are coming from deep outer space that we only barely have an inkling of, that also could threaten the survival of life on this planet. So what they've proposed is going beyond SDI to a strategic defense of the Earth, which would involve a space-based capability for early warning detection and interception of space-based matter that could be plunging towards the planet. Now, I had a discussion recently with a leading American scientist who's been involved in elements of the SDI program from the very outset back in the 1980s. And even though the original LaRouche-Reagan SDI was largely sabotaged and certainly was not pursued as a crash program for very long at all, the fact is that 30 years have now passed since Reagan's speech, almost 30 years, a few months off. And in that period, there have been substantial advances. There have been advances in particle beam lasers. There have been advances in high-speed computer miniaturized processes, so that it's the view among some leading scientists that a strategic defense initiative deployment at this point is within reach and is feasible and should be pursued. This would end the problems of the European missile defense deployment. It would make the so-called threat of Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon laughable. It would deal with problems in North Asia, like the North Korean nuclear capability. It would end the danger of some kind of conflict between India and Pakistan erupting into a limited nuclear exchange there. All of these things would be solved by going forward and implementing the original SDI proposal, which is now a stepping stone to this larger issue of the strategic defense of the Earth. And of course, with the Curiosity breakthrough, the landing of the Curiosity mission on the surface of Mars, it's very clear that this is not some kind of science fiction, but something that is doable with a concerted effort, and it's already underway.
Well, Jeff, the idea then is that the seeds are there for getting out of this crisis, but I'd like to come back to a couple of specifics on the current situation again. On the one side, you have the Netanyahu-Ehud Barak collaboration, which has been exposed in the Israeli press. The latest is the former Israel Defense Forces chief, General Gabi Ashkenazi,
right,
who came out just, I think, in the last 24 hours. Virtually everyone who knows anything about military policy in Israel has said, don't do it. Do you think Netanyahu's crazy enough to do this?
Well, look, Netanyahu has not yet been told publicly, point blank, by President Obama not to do it. So what does that tell Netanyahu? It tells him that this is yet perhaps one more example where Obama is, to use his own formulation, quote, leading from behind. If Obama is not telling Netanyahu no in a firm and decisive fashion, isn't that tantamount to telling him yes with a wink and a nod? That's the problem you're dealing with. Netanyahu is banking on the fact that, especially as Obama becomes more and more fixated, like Emperor Nero, on his re-election and becomes more and more worried about whether he's going to win or not, an Israeli attack on Iran would almost certainly draw the United States in to finish the job. There was a study done two, 3 years ago by the Washington Institute for Near East Policy where they said Israel doesn't have to succeed. All they have to do is throw the first punch, because the United States, with the power of the Israeli lobby and everything else, will be able to be drawn in to finish the job.
So if we had a real president, the way, for example, Eisenhower told the British to get out of the Sinai and out of the Suez in 1956, if we had a real president who told Netanyahu to stand down, it's highly unlikely that the Israelis would go ahead.
I think they would simply not go ahead. The problem is that Obama is driving these wars. Let's go back to Syria and, you know, look at that situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was quite stunned. There's an article today in the London Economist. They've been cheerleading for the Syrian opposition and the overthrow of Bashar Assad for the last 2 years. They have a very frank assessment that the rebels are in the process of being routed. They describe the rebels, in their own words, as, quote, starting to wilt, and that they made a strategic blunder, thinking that they could launch frontal attacks against the two biggest cities in the country, Damascus and Aleppo. They were routed in Damascus. They've been routed now in Aleppo. And the middle class majority, Sunni middle class majority in those two cities, has thoroughly rejected the opposition. The Syrian National Council, which was supposed to be the unifying force in the leadership to replace Bashar Assad and the Ba'athist Party, is coming apart at the seams. When she was recently in Istanbul, Hillary Clinton didn't even meet with them, wouldn't give them the time of day. The Economist says that the Syrian National Council is, quote, on the verge of irrelevance. I mean, this is no surprise to us. We knew that this is where this situation was headed. But nevertheless, 2 days ago, President Obama got on the phone with David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and then came out and announced that he's on the verge of ordering military action against Syria outside the framework of the United Nations Security Council. Why? Because of the potential, quote, movement of chemical weapons around the country. He didn't say, we will intervene if Assad orders the use of chemical weapons against his own population. He said, if we pick up signs that these chemical weapon stockpiles are being moved around, that will cause us enough alarm to launch military action outside the framework of the UN Security Council. Now, doesn't that remind you of Condi Rice and Dick Cheney's nuclear mushroom clouds coming from Iraq back in 2002, 2003, before the invasion? I mean, come on, we were not born yesterday. The same propaganda is being played out all over again. And it's, Lyndon LaRouche said this week, he said, it's being done because the American people are suckers for this kind of lie.
I was just going to say that the other, when you talk about unintended consequences, the use of Turkey as a staging area seems to have backfired as well, with the Kurdish rebellion and the emboldening of the opposition to the current government there.
Yeah, sure. It's no surprise whatsoever that it's basically reaching the point where it spilled over into Turkey. Hillary Clinton warned several months ago, around the time of that Geneva meeting, just before Kofi Annan resigned, that basically this thing was about to trigger a larger regional war. That was one of the reasons she said the U.S. would not get involved militarily. But tough luck, she's been overridden by President Obama, who wants to start using military hardware directly. No-fly zone, humanitarian corridor. It's all the language of R2P and humanitarian interventionism.
Well, Jeff, we have about 10 minutes left, and I want you to speak to our listeners out there, our supporters, many of whom want to see Obama out. They want to see it happen, but they're so victimized by the sense that nothing will change. And one of the examples that I've been using is the case of Erich Honecker, the dictator of East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, who in 1989, I think in October, spoke about the DDR lasting for another 1,000 years, and about a month later he was in exile in Chile.
Right.
There are many other examples of this, but clearly it's going to take something that will include a reaction from the American people besides giving a negative response to a pollster. We've had days of action. We're getting out leaflets. We're going to have a new report coming out on the strategic defense of Earth. But what do people have to, Lynn is talking about people having to get the guts to break with popular opinion. I wonder if you can just talk about that for a minute, because the Congress isn't going to move unless they've got a foot in their rear end.
Well, you're hearing it first here on this show. The final part of the discussion that we had with Lynn this morning dealt with this question of people's fear of staring the reality of thermonuclear war in the face. And so as we speak, the LaRouche Political Action Committee website team is crashing to produce a very powerful video that will be posted on the website and circulated prior to the beginning of the Democratic Convention to basically give people a graphic picture of what thermonuclear war, what thermonuclear extinction will actually be like. We're going to go back to the newsreel footage from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because I was there about 20 years ago in Japan, and I visited the memorial at Hiroshima. And first of all, the bomb that was used, that was dropped from the Enola Gay on Hiroshima, is minuscule compared to the hydrogen bombs that now exist in overkill arsenals in the United States, Russia, and China. But I'll never forget the scene there, because of the entire city, I forget how many million people lived there before the bombing. Of the entire city, only one portion of one building survived the blast, and that was an old castle that was the provincial interior ministry headquarters, and basically a fragment of one wall of that building is all that remained after the atomic bomb was dropped. And at that memorial, they have a room which has, it's a circular room, and you have 360 degrees uninterrupted photograph of the entire city as it existed after the bomb was dropped. And you see the devastation. I forget who it was, but someone once commented, I think it might have been John Kennedy around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, basically said that in the event of thermonuclear war, the lucky ones will be the ones that die instantly. The ones who will suffer the most will be those that survive the initial blast.
I think the actual quote is, the survivors will envy the dead.
Yeah. So we are putting together a report, a very factual report, to present to the American people the consequences of their willingness to tolerate the continuation of Obama in office. And you've got to use tough images, you've got to use blunt, truthful language to get people to basically find their sense of morality and mission again. And I think that's really about all that you can say right now. Fortunately, there are people in leading institutions, particularly the military and intelligence and diplomatic establishments, both here as well as in Russia and China, who do have a grasp of the gravity of the situation, who do understand the danger of general war, and who are proceeding from that standpoint. So you have an active fight in the political realm. We're leading that fight unambiguously. And there are others. There are people who are already mobilized. But it's the American people that have got to realize that they're the backbone and the spine of this effort. You're not going to get action out of Washington unless there is a grassroots movement with pitchforks in hand demanding a change in policy. From the standpoint of war avoidance, Obama's got to go. From the standpoint of Glass-Steagall and an economics recovery, Obama's got to go. And the legal framework, the constitutional framework, exists for that to happen. You could get an article coming out tomorrow revealing that Obama was personally involved in the decision to leak crucial national security secrets to boost his polling numbers. If such an article came out, that would be curtains for Obama. It would create the invitation for the Democratic convention to pick an alternative candidate. And I can assure you, if the Democrats open up the convention to an alternative candidate, if there's even movement in that direction, the Republicans will scramble to try to come up with their own alternative. Although, of course, their convention starts the day after tomorrow.
Well, we all remember, actually, those of us who are older, remember the case of Senator Eagleton, who came out of the convention as the Democratic vice presidential nominee.
Right.
And within a few weeks, he was dumped.
Yeah.
So, but the point is not to convince people that it can happen. The point is that people have to have a sense that it's their responsibility. And this is the point that Mr. LaRouche is making, that if you don't want to have thermonuclear war, you have to do something. It's in your hands. Our Constitution is unique in that sense. And the idea is not for us to come up with a scenario, but to get people who are already leaning in the direction of getting rid of Obama to inspire them and give them the courage to act. And that's what's been lacking so far in American politics.
That's right. But as you say, there are sparks that indicate a potential. You had the Keisha Rogers victory in Texas. You had Bill Roberts' 41% vote in Michigan. You had the two opportunities where a minor candidate, challenged Obama in the Democratic primaries in West Virginia and Louisiana.
And Arkansas.
Yeah. And got over 40% of the vote.
And a group of Democrats got over 40% in Oklahoma, and uncommitted got over 40% in Kentucky.
Right.
I think also, Jeff, there's a report out, I mean, we didn't touch on this much, but there's a report out on the economy which shows that people are worse off in terms of their financial situation under the Obama recovery than they were during the Bush recession.
Yep.
And so it means, among other things, we have to change the nomenclature of recovery, recession, and actually look at different parameters when we're dealing with an economy. Jeff, in the last 60 seconds, what should people do?
Well, I think, number one, be on the lookout for this video and get it out extremely widely. There are leaflets up on the LPAC website. Call your congressman, call your delegates to the Democratic convention, and tell them to cut the crap. We need a viable president. We need a president who is not going to drive us to thermonuclear extinction. Clearly, Obama is heading us in that direction. Clearly, Romney, with especially his vice presidential running mate, Paul Ryan, is not an alternative. In fact, if anything was being done to get Obama reelected, it was the selection of Romney and the choice of Ryan as his running mate. It scares the hell out of people and allows them to delude themselves that the country and the world can survive Obama, which it absolutely cannot.
All right, well, that's going to do it for our program. And Jeff, thanks for coming on. And as always, it was a lucid analysis. And let's just hope that people are going to think and act as Americans with the courage to do what's right. So this has been another edition of The LaRouche Show. We will be back next week, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of The LaRouche Show.